You're listening to Write the Book, the podcast for writers and curious readers coming from Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont author Cardi Raper, whose new book is An American Harvest, How One Family Moved from Dirt-Poor Farming to a Better Life in the Early 1900s. This is published by Green Writers Press. Carlene, or Cardi Raper, is an extensively published author in national and international scientific journals. She's also authored several book chapters. She received a master's in science degree from the University of Chicago in 1946 and a PhD from Harvard in 1977. She was a research associate and lecturer in biology at Harvard, an assistant professor of biology at Wellesley, and a research professor at the University of Vermont from 1983 until her official retirement as emerita in 1994. She was awarded over 20 grants for her research from the National Science Foundation, the National Institutes of Health, and the United States Department of Agriculture, among others. She was an invited speaker at numerous international symposia and at colleges, universities, and industries in the U.S., Canada, Europe, Israel, and Japan. Dr. Raper is listed in Who's Who of American Women and American Men and Women of Science, The World Who's Who of Women, and she was recently honored as a dedicatee for the book Sex in Fungi, Molecular Determination and Evolutionary Implications. In recognition of her distinguished contributions to the field of biological science, Carlene A. Raper was elected Fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in November 2012. Her new book is An American Harvest. It's sometimes sad, sometimes humorous, sometimes scandalous. It is the real-life tale of seven brothers and one sister who grew up poor on a worn-out tobacco farm in North Carolina. One of those brothers was her late husband, John. They tell in their own words how each, with strong parental guidance, moved on to achieve distinguished careers in a variety of professions. When I spoke with Cardi Raper, I asked how she came to write An American Harvest, which is the story of her late husband's family.
The Raper family, whom I married into, has reunions every 5 years. Mm-hmm. One of which occurred in 1965, and I and my husband were in charge of that one, organizing it. So what we did was to engage a motel, practically took it over in Booth Bay Harbor, Maine, for the whole family. And there were about 40 or 50 of us attending, mm-hmm. many generations. There were originally seven boys and one girl in that family, but since the previous reunion, one of the oldest one had died. So there were six boys attending, men by then, and the one daughter of this large family, who were all brought up in a poor tobacco farm in North Carolina. And I think it was my idea originally, that it would be a good time and maybe the only time to ask all the members of the family who were attending to come prepared to talk about their childhood together on that farm, what it was like, what life was like in the early 20th century. I'd heard stories about it, but I'd never had a full report from all the family. Mm-hmm. So we had just bought a tape recorder. In those days, you had a tape recorder.
Right.
And we brought it, and the folks did bring some materials, letters and writings, and we had a round table discussion, and I tape recorded it, and thank goodness.
Yes.
As soon as it was recorded, a secretary of my husband, who was then a professor at Harvard, heard the recording, said, "Oh, this is precious. I need to transcribe it." So she just voluntarily typed it all out. Because a few years later, the tapes bled, and they are no longer any good.
Oh.
And I never, I didn't know that I had to restore them.
Yeah.
So all this material was original. It's down on paper, black and white. I scanned it into the computer. And then 50 years later.
Right. Now, why? Why the timing? I'm curious.
Well, the timing is that I thought the material was very interesting. I thought this family was very interesting. And I think it was worth putting out there. In fact, I had shown the material, the raw material, to several of my friends who didn't even know this family much.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, this is really precious. You should do something with it. So I tried to put it together in some format for publishers to pick it up and be interested in, you know, making something of it. Sent it to maybe a dozen, no, maybe only half a dozen publishers.
Right.
And one of them, Little Brown, was quite interested. They said, we'd like to work with you on this. Well, within a couple of weeks, my husband had died.
Oh, and that was in the 70s.
That was 74 he died, yeah. So I put it aside. I had to figure right. out, what am I going to do now?
Right.
And it'd been lying there for a long, long time. So finally and I've asked several people to help me with it, and it's difficult because here they are talking about whatever comes into their head.
Yes.
And you have to try to make it flow into a sort of story that has sort of topics that flow from one to the other.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I finally figured I'll put in a little narration as well
mm-hmm.
and make it read like a story. I finally did that, and I showed it to Dee Dee Cummings, who is the publisher of Greenwriter Press, and she liked it very much, and she said, I want to publish this.
Oh, that's great.
So it was published in April of this year,
okay.
19. What is, no, this year is 2016.
2016. You went for the 16 and went for the 19.
Yeah, that's right.
So did John know that you would eventually write this? I mean, he must have known the Little Brown thing was in the works at that
yes.
time.
Yeah, he knew I was working on it. It was in the days when I could work at night.
Mm-hmm.
I worked during the day as a scientist in his laboratory.
Right.
But I was working on this at night. And those were the days when I had the energy to do that.
So you already mentioned that there's a sort of conversational format to the recordings, and that is the format that you'd carried over into the book.
Yes.
And I liked that because I felt like the reader kind of gets to discover things about this family as they themselves discover things about each other that they may have forgotten or, mm-hmm. or they didn't know, or, you know, gee, you know, I wasn't in town when that happened. That's really interesting, you know, and so I enjoyed that format. Who helped you decide to keep that format instead of writing some sort of straight biography?
That's interesting because there were some suggestions from very knowledgeable people, mm-hmm. writers themselves, and editors who said, why don't you make it a work of fiction?
Oh, interesting.
And I thought, well, no, I think their words are far more interesting than anything I could dream up.
Mm-hmm.
That's maybe my failing. I'm not innovative enough, but I thought what they said and how they said it was really treasurable.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to keep that, but I threw out a lot of stuff. I didn't show the whole transcript. I didn't report the entire transcript.
Mm-hmm.
And I was quite selective about how I formatted it.
Yes.
And
yeah.
in what order I would put it. But I did keep it as a conversation.
Yeah.
And to me, what emerged from all this that is so interesting is that everybody's memory is different, no matter
True.
If they've experienced the same thing in the same place, but they're different people, different ages.
Yeah.
And they contradict one another on their memories.
Very politely.
Mostly
yeah, very politely.
Quite polite, but they're yeah. rather sarcastic.
Yeah.
As siblings would be.
Right.
The sibling rivalry comes out in this conversation
mm-hmm.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting that there are seven, well, in the conversation there were seven males, one of whom was the husband of the single girl sibling.
Yeah.
And
Blanche.
The fact that there's only one sibling who is a girl.
Right.
Blanche,
yeah,
and what her position was with respect to the boys.
Yeah. Well, before we move off of the format of the conversational format, I also liked that each of their own voices came through because you kept that. And I felt like the voice of the time comes through. You know, there's a different way of speaking. They were very. It is a little bit dated, isn't it? The way that they spoke, it was very as I said, polite, but very educated and, I don't know. How would you describe the voice of the time, or do you know what I'm talking about?
I do know what you're talking about, and I think it was that they, even though they all started out in a one-room schoolhouse, they must have had a teacher or teachers who knew how to teach the English language
yeah.
and how to speak it.
Yeah.
And so they were schooled. They were, and school was no fooling around. Even though the school term was shorter then than it is now because it had to accommodate the farm work.
Right.
Those kids did learn how to speak and how to write. And what, you know, what all the parts of a sentence are.
Yeah.
The noun, the verbs, and all that stuff.
What was involved in turning the recordings into a book? You've already said that you didn't include the whole session. So how did you decide what to include, and did you have editorial help at that point, or did you draft it before you showed it to Dee Dee?
Well, it was quite a long process. I said that I picked it up again almost 50 years after the recording was made and after the material was available. And I had worked on it previously to some extent, but I was trying hard to figure out how to do it. For instance, it came to me in something of a flash that I could name, that I needed chapters,
mm-hmm.
and that I could title the chapters after the numerous aphorisms that these kids had to learn.
Right,
as
it
youngsters.
Was their mother Julia's sort of
motto. The mother was Moravian.
That's a question I have.
Yes.
I did not know what that was.
Ah.
The Moravian religion. I had to look it up. And I asked some friends of mine that I was with the other day because they were talking about Moravian stars and decorating for the holidays. And I said, okay, so I do know that there's a Moravian star, mm-hmm. but I don't know the Moravian religion. And there were four of us, one, two, three, four, five of us in the room. Nobody had heard of that religion. So is that...
Well, it's I would say you might relate it to some extent to Moravians, to Amish cults, but not that severe.
Mm.
There was a wonderful story that I have included here that Arthur tells, I think.
Right.
About the mother talking about her father
mm-hmm.
missing a ham from the smokehouse.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And the way that was handled by the father going out there. Yes, he noticed that the ham was missing, and he just stayed up one night and watched the smokehouse, and he saw a neighbor come by
right.
and go into his smokehouse. And he said, "May I help thee load, brother? You must need this worse than I." And that neighbor never stole again from that smokehouse.
Yeah.
And I guess he must have told the other neighbors not to go steal from Mr. Krause.
Yeah.
He was so generous.
So did you grow up knowing what Moravian religion was?
No, I did not.
No.
I think it originated in what is now, or at least the cult was in southern, what is now southern, the Republic of Czechoslovakia.
Mm-hmm.
I visited down there. That's where Mendel held forth in southern
parts interesting.
Of the Republic of Czechoslovakia. They came over quite early.
Mm-hmm.
They came over probably in the early part of the 19th century or the late part of the 18th century as religious, you know, for religious freedom, to practice their religion.
Right.
And, many of them settled in the South. How they became, now that was the Krause side. That was the Moravian side.
The Krause
Julia's
side being Julia's
Krause, yes.
family.
The father, Raper, came from England, and he was Methodist.
Okay. He was an interesting character.
Yes.
I enjoyed reading about Frank. Frank was not necessarily a skillful farmer, or maybe it wasn't where his heart lay.
Right.
But he was an incredible member of the community. He wanted to improve his community. He wanted to help build infrastructure. He thought about a political bid at one point. Now, you didn't know him.
No, unfortunately, I didn't know either.
Of the parents?
Of those parents. But I heard a lot about them.
Yeah.
And they did differ in their aspirations for all these children. Mm-hmm. The mother was much more traditional in her background, that she had other relatives in the vicinity who had better farms than they did, and she thought Frank could be a better farmer and concentrate more on the farming business rather than giving so much money to causes that fostered education and distracting the children,
right,
to the degree that he did.
And he wanted his children to all be educated.
He did.
Yeah.
Get off that farm.
And he won. So do you think that he was not a skillful farmer, or do you think it has more to do with that's not really what he would have chosen for his life's work?
I think it's more the latter.
Yeah. And do you think that's why none of the children took over the farm in the end?
Absolutely. The reason was that he did get them all off to college, and they helped each other go through college.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked very, very hard, dawn to dusk, and you know, the day of rest was Sunday when they went to church at least twice, sometimes three times on Sunday.
Wow.
But, and they had a lot of very, very strong ethical teaching. The religious part, the details of the religion didn't hold on into adulthood the way perhaps that they were taught, but the ethics remained.
Right. And that brings us actually back to your chapter headings, which are these aphorisms that mm-hmm. Julia would use. Could you want to just tell us a few of them?
Oh, yeah. See if I can remember them. Knowledge is power.
And then maybe you can talk a little bit about how you decided to structure the material within each of those
right. yeah.
categories.
Yeah, I love these. They're all very short. Hearken to good advice. Learn to do well. Be always learning. Do wrong to none. Beware of evil. Never give up. Always be prompt. Knowledge is power. Wisdom is strength. Idleness leads to vice. Be cheerful. Do your best. If you can, if you will, speak the truth. No lie thrives. Dare to do right. Never be late. Obey orders. Strive to please. Time is money. Trust is noble. Learn to wait. Be polite. Never be idle. Don't be proud. Strive to do right. I guess I said that once before. No, there's strive to please. That's right. Leave evil companions and obey the conscience.
And that wasn't even all of them, right? There were...
there are many, many.
Many,
yes.
many. Yeah. So how did you pick them, and how did you structure the material within?
That was a kind of breakthrough for me.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, I'm going to take some of these, and I'll look at the material and see what fits more or less mm-hmm. in their conversation with each of these concepts.
Yeah.
And, of course, there were some bad things that happened in that community.
Right, yeah.
Shenanigans and some of the people who didn't do their share of barn raising and
right. Well, and beyond that, I mean, Blanche's husband told some stories that were much more intense than the brother's stories of even like violence.
Yes. Murder.
Murder. Yeah.
And so, you know, he remembered more about the evil forces, but up to the time he pitched in the conversation, the rapers had been speaking very nostalgically,
yes.
bucolically.
Yes, and he does sort of say, hey, what about this?
That's not all.
That's not all that was there.
Yeah, right. So,
yeah.
So I tried to order it in that way,
mm-hmm.
and I tried to figure it out so that if you get at the end of one chapter, you want to go on to the next because we're going to talk about something like religion and the force of that and so forth.
Yeah. Now, was John the youngest or was...
John was the youngest.
He was, okay.
crazily enough, there were four brunettes and four redheads.
Oh, right.
Four and four. So the first four were brunettes and the last four were redheads.
That's interesting.
And my husband was the last of them.
Uh-huh.
If they had stopped with Blanche, the daughter, the only daughter, that would have been the size of the family I came from, because I was the last and only daughter in my family.
And which number were you?
I was number six.
Six.
Five older brothers.
Okay. Okay. And then in between Blanche and John was?
Howard. Let's see. No, Kenneth.
Kenneth. Okay, because I remember there was a picture.
Kenneth, yeah.
Kenneth and John as really, really young children, and you wrote, these are the scientists.
They are.
That was fun. Yeah. Where did you find the photos? Photos for the book?
You know, a lot of them came from a scrapbook that Julia had kept and was passed on to her daughter Blanche, who kept it. And she kept everything that she could. Mm-hmm. Newspaper clippings, these boys of hers, several of them accomplished some very noteworthy things.
Yeah.
And they were in the newspaper, and it was written up in the newspaper, and their pictures were in the newspaper. So she had pictures and clippings and everything she could get a hold of.
Plus there were letters,
exactly.
Certain letters,
yes.
From Julia.
Yes.
And I think some letters through the years from siblings to each other, a couple.
Yes, yes.
And that was interesting because that made me think about what we've lost as a society or as, you know, members of our communities. How many people are really writing letters anymore, you know? And, I mean, we're all texting back and forth so fast in one little line to another. But, you know, if anybody wants to write the story of a contemporary life in 30 years, I don't think there's going to be a lot of letters.
No, it's a different...
It's a different time.
Time and different way.
Yeah.
I think the fact that they were able to think about this ahead of time, Ralph, for instance, who
The reunion.
Yes, before the reunion. One of the boys, Ralph, became a deputy in the Department of USDA, Department of Agriculture, and a cotton expert. And he came with a whole bunch of poems that just came into his head.
Yeah.
And he just delivered them to me. It was just a lot of poems. And I thought, well, I'm not going to put those out there as a whole, you know, page after page of poems, but I'll select from them and make them the introductions to where appropriate to the subject that I'm talking about in each chapter. And then as something stirs my memory of my childhood, I come forth with my own memories and how they differ from...
You have italicized sections
of
your own relevant memories to each particular... Did this bring up a lot of memories for you as you were working on this?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
And things you had forgotten altogether?
To some extent, yes. And since I had previously written a memoir and I had checked some of the so-called facts of that memoir...
Yes.
...with mutual acquaintances, I said, I don't remember anything like that. I don't remember it that way. And it was so clear as I went through the Raper discussion that, yes, all families, everybody does that.
Yeah. And I was glad you included your own memories because I think there is the temptation to see maybe the Raper story in the context of time and as it existed representing an entire time period. But your stories also showed a difference between two families, and you're younger than John, but, you know, still your own childhood, you know, it's a little bit later, but also it's different geographical and a different culture. You know, you're not from that same family in North Carolina. And so we were able to see the differences that existed within that time period, too, which was good.
Yes, and my farm experiences were fun.
Yeah.
I had this oldest brother who made everything seem like fun. He ran the farm, and, I would get promoted from pitching hay to driving the manure spreader. That was a big deal. Whereas my husband was always complaining about the farm work.
Right, and that was an interesting aspect of the book. You said that John, or he said, actually, on the recording, that he had always felt he had worked harder than any of the other siblings because he was one of the youngest, or because he was the youngest. And so they all kind of moved on, and he had to take over whatever duties lay for him.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so he was the youngest and I think was left with a lot of chores. I was the youngest and I was treasured.
Mm-hmm.
And so my outlook on life was somewhat different from his.
Well, and then the other thing is his father was sick.
That's
and
true.
Toward the end of Frank's life, he couldn't do as much as he once had. So that put even more pressure on John, probably.
Right. Yes.
Yes,
he didn't remember his father as a well person, whereas the older ones did.
And he had a heart problem.
He had a heart problem that he lived with, that he was supposed to die. I guess the father was supposed to die in mid-age, but he hung in there until he was 60-something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Write the Book and an interview with the author, Cardi Raper, whose 2016 novel is An American Harvest, published by Green Writers Press. If you're enjoying the podcast, I would love it if you would go to iTunes and rate it, review it, or just pass along the show's information to some friends. Thanks, and do keep listening.
I wanted to just talk about some of the details. I loved the details. One of the stories that really captured my attention was Blanche talking about her household duties with her mother when the boys were out working on the farm, although sometimes she worked on the farm, but a lot of what she did was working inside the house with her mother. And one thing they would do is collect rags that would then be taken out and turned into carpets.
Right.
And they would come back looking beautiful. So do you know what that process was?
Actually, I can't give you the name of it, but you do make a rag carpet out of old rags, and my daughter-in-law can do that. She's made one.
Is that the spiral thing that you see?
They're oval and spiral.
Yes.
And they're made into long lines that are woven, sort of braided together.
Right.
And then they're attached to one another. And they're usually made out of cotton or, you know, some old whatever's left cast off. The mother made practically all their clothing.
Yeah.
They never went out to eat at a restaurant.
And they basically grew all their food, right?
They pretty grew much most of their food. They did, they grew some wheat, I guess, and got that milled elsewhere. And I guess they had to buy sugar and a couple of other items. But mostly they were very self-sustaining.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have any electricity. They didn't have any refrigeration. They didn't have any central heating. And the way they kept the food was to either smoke or salt it or put it in the hillside and keep it over the summer where it's cooler underground.
Yeah. And it's amazing, just the story. And I loved the details, you know, the details of the cooking and what they would cook and what they would eat.
They'd slaughter a hog.
They'd slaughter a hog.
And eat every part.
Every single part. Now, did you interject that John wanted you to eat some of the pieces of the pig that he used to enjoy and you were not so keen?
Well, you know, we tried it out. I was willing to try brains and then I was willing to try pork hocks and what was it? Pig ears.
Yeah.
And, of course, we had little kids at the time, so we would try to introduce them to what, you know, Papa used to eat these. And it just, you know, we tried.
We tried. Yeah. Oh, that's funny. Well, the details I thought really filled in the world and actually kind of balanced that interview style of narrative, you know, and I loved the fact that they came up with such wonderful memories to share. It was good that you gave them time to think about it ahead of time. A lot of them had written things down that they wanted to share, and they became almost a little competitive about speaking over each other.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, you were there for the whole thing, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
In fact, my daughter and my son was there when they were young teenagers, and they remember it very fondly.
And did all the siblings know you were thinking about writing a book at some point?
No.
Mm-mm.
They just knew that I wanted this material for posterity, mainly to pass down to the family, because we knew that this is a family that stays together, is going to be together. We still have these 5-year reunions. We had one last year, and 50 people came of like 5 generations.
I think that's fantastic.
And they live all over the country now, but they come together.
Yeah.
And there's this rivalry between the blood rapers and the married-in rapers. And you take pictures of the spouses, who are mostly female, versus the males, who are the real rapers. And we'd say, yeah, we need a picture of all the spouses who married into those rapers because, you know, we're better than they. We have to put up with them. And all those kind of family.
Yeah. Now, one aspect that I thought was really interesting was the discussions of sex.
Uh-huh.
And they all started talking about, you know, how they learned about sex. And there was this great line, I guess their mother said to someone, pigs come out of knots on logs and babies are let down from heaven by a rope.
Right.
And I thought, well, now that's so interesting. They live on a farm. Huh. It's interesting that the parents would skirt the subject or offer kind of, you know, fable instead of fact.
Right.
Did that strike you?
Well, it was part of that religion.
Okay.
You did not talk about sex and religion. You
not even to explain it.
Angels, no. However, the children did observe the animals.
Sure.
So they finally got the picture.
Yeah.
But, you know, meantime, some of them would think, well, Dr. Bob always came to deliver the next child. And Dr. Bob had a little satchel, and, you know, the old story that the baby was brought in the satchel.
Right.
And that was believable when you're maybe three.
Yeah. Or a gullible five.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was Arthur who sort of dominated the whole thing, but he was elected moderator. He was instinctively a very fine
Now, they had already lost one sibling
right
at this point. Right?
The oldest.
Cletus. Okay.
He died of a heart attack.
And so was Arthur the second oldest?
No, Luther.
Luther, okay.
Who became the member, I guess he was the chairman involved in membership
okay.
of the biggest Southern cooperative at the time
uh-huh.
When he grew up.
All right. It was also interesting to me their differences of opinion around their father's religious views.
Right.
Arthur felt pretty strongly that their father had been quite religious, didn't he?
Well, John thought his father was fundamentalist and really didn't.
Oh, that's okay.
Now, fundamentalist meaning that he really did believe in the Bible literally.
Mm-hmm.
However, the older ones apparently saw another side of that father when he was feeling better. When he was healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And he did question the virgin birth, and he did question certain things about the religion, but he felt fundamentally it's very good to have this religion
mm-hmm.
and to, you know, have the ethics and make your commitments and stick by them.
Now, which religion were the children raised?
Both.
Oh, they went to both churches.
Oh, absolutely.
And
in
they
fact,
were raised
they got
to
their
believe
love,
both.
Their wonderful interest in music through the Moravians. They had wonderful... Oh, it was brass bands that would play at Easter and, and Christmas time, beautiful music. And that's where John got his love of music and almost became a professional trumpeter rather than a scientist.
And you play the trumpet, too.
I did, too.
Which was so interesting to me. When you met, was that one of the things that drew you together, that you both were scientists who played the trumpet?
Yeah, I don't remember. I know we both had trumpets at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And... I guess we knew before we got married that we were going to play our trumpets together.
Yeah. So were you ever in a band together?
No. My husband was really in the North Carolina Symphony Orchestra under Thor Johnson, who was a very fine conductor. And he was a very good trumpeter in the terms of his fingering and his tonguing. I was very good in terms of tone, but I wasn't so good with the triple tonguing and the finger work. So together we would try to play at the lab at night, and the janitor complained.
Oh, that's funny.
So we went to recorders.
Wouldn't his job be more interesting if you were playing the trumpet at night?
Well, who knows who the janitor was.
Maybe he's trying to sleep.
Who knows?
So one thing that I thought you must have sort of bonded with Blanche over is the fact that she was a woman from a certain era who went to school and got a job and, you know, had a career, and that was pretty unusual back then. And I think that
very
even
so.
When you came of age, that was mm-hmm. probably still pretty unusual.
Yeah, I did relate in that she had a much more strict schooling from her mother than I did. My mother... When I told her I wanted to be a scientist, she said, "Yeah, well, you can be a nurse." But but that was that was my first memoir.
Yeah,
my memoir. But for Blanche, when she said to her mother, "Yeah, she wanted to go to college," and her mother was concerned about her dating
right.
boys outside the neighborhood. There was a very nice boy, Aubrey, who came from a very nice family, and they knew him, and that should be for Blanche. But Blanche went away to college, and she met other boys, and she was told, her mother said, "I want you to promise you won't dance."
Right.
That was not permitted. And Blanche didn't promise, but she said, "I never could dance."
Because she knew her mother would so disapprove.
Yes.
But she wouldn't promise.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that was a different era from me. My mother knew I was going to go dating and dancing and so forth.
Right. And then Blanche did marry Aubrey.
She did.
Yeah.
Yes, she did.
In the end. And she was a teacher.
She was.
Yeah.
And a poet.
And a poet.
And she wrote music, and she was a, she, in her old age, she became a theatrical person, and she really was a wonderful person.
What an interesting family. And the thing that really strikes me is they all went on to become very interesting and educated and sort of at the height of whatever field each of them chose.
That's
and
true.
Yet did something completely different from what either of their parents had ever done. So what do you attribute that to, anything in particular?
Ethics.
Hard
work.
Do you think Frank's desire to improve his community was a model for them in
absolutely,
that way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Particularly for Arthur. Mm. Arthur was very involved in trying to, in relations with the blacks in the South at the mm-hmm. time. He wrote several scholarly books about lynching and about sharecroppers and agricultural economics. And he was very, very conscious about wanting to help people mm-hmm. all out throughout the world, even after World War II. He traveled all over the world and helped with agricultural practices in the countries that in Japan and Afghanistan and Pakistan, all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So that definitely what came from his father, I think. Where the science comes in, I don't know, but I think farm life is quite challenging. I mean, they didn't have much in the way of equipment at all, and it was always breaking down, like, you know, the wagon needed repair or the crops needed fertilizing or should you put in fertilizer or shouldn't you, and how
right.
do you do this and how do you do that, and actually growing cigarette tobacco, which was called bright leaf at that time, is a very, very tricky crop to grow, and it takes a lot of ingenuity and care.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were always challenged in that respect. So no matter what they took up in life, they were facing problems mm-hmm. that had to be solved. And they figured out how to solve them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was that very strong sense of commitment to your job, to other people, and the ethics of how do you do it, and do you do it as well as you possibly can.
Yeah. Yeah. Was it fun to write the book?
Yes, because I love reading over this material over and over and over again.
Yeah. Had you through the years read the material over and over?
I would pick it up every once in a while.
Yeah.
And think, now what can I do with it?
Yeah. And so this came out in April. How long ago did you start really kind of applying yourself to putting it together?
I would say maybe a year and a half before.
Okay.
Uh-huh. With all that background. Yeah.
And how much is not included from those transcripts?
Oh, goodness, I don't know. I still have a tremendous file.
Mm.
I have pictures I haven't used. I have writings and letters and so forth that I didn't use. And I don't know what I'm saving them for. Maybe I have a family that loves things like that, so maybe they'll keep it intact.
Yeah.
I have a daughter who would be interested in
family museum.
Yeah.
One thing that I loved was just these little references that, so the Moravian Church, for me, that was a reference that I wasn't familiar with, but I'm sure some people would be. But there were other little references, like in one of Julia's letters, she talks about a new minister coming to town, and they went to pound the minister's
yes.
family. And I guess that was a welcoming tradition.
Yes, and I had to find out what that meant.
And that was so yeah. interesting. So it's bringing a pound of sugar, a pound of flour. Is that right?
I don't know where that word comes from.
Oh,
but
I thought
think
that's what it said in the
okay,
book.
Okay, could be. I have one relative who is married to a preacher.
Right.
Of the South, and he could clue me in on some of these.
Oh, okay.
Old sayings.
Let's see. In the book, last night we pounded Mr. Goforth, which is a great
Mr.
name,
Goforth,
by the way.
Yeah.
And then you wrote, or I think it's you, pounding here means welcoming a new minister with a pound each of cooking essentials such as butter, flour, sugar,
okay.
and so forth.
Okay, I'd forgotten that.
Mr. Goforth. I love that. And tomorrow I must fix for the Thanksgiving sale we will have at the schoolhouse. I loved her letters. I love just to see what she wrote.
Well, it's interesting. She was an excellent speller. She won all the spelling bees, but she didn't know anything about punctuation, and her letters were just all run on. but they were very well spelled. Whereas the father didn't know anything about grammar or spelling.
Right. And neither of them had much education. I think she went through maybe fourth grade.
Fourth grade, and he went through seventh. And I think she got better training in English than he did, or she had a better memory maybe.
He had to go work on the farm sometimes when the girls were allowed to stay in school.
That's possible. She had six sisters.
Oh, wow.
And he had, a bunch of brothers, but those were big families in those days.
Yeah, yeah. So are you writing anything new now?
Actually, I'm trying to, I'm just starting a book about my mother, who was born in the Victorian age, and she kept everything as well.
Oh,
letters,
good.
Letters, lucky. Letters, pictures, everything, documents. She lost her mother when she was only seven.
Oh.
And her father was her primary influence, and he was a true Victorian who wrote a book called The American Family. And in The American Family, women have their role. They are the homemakers. They are the ones who bear the children and take care of the children and take care of the husband. And the husband goes out in the world and does all the things that need to be done out in the world, including voting and all that sort of thing. And yet my mother, having emerged from that and living another 87 years, lived through quite a period of transition. And
sure.
She had this daughter who, wouldn't abide anything that grandfather of hers wrote in that book. So I want to write it as an emerging Victorian. I noticed lately there are several books out about Queen Victoria, and she was born in Queen Victoria's age.
Yeah.
And the influence was there.
Yeah.
And so I want to work that into it.
That's interesting.
And yeah. I think it will be mostly from my point of view, because I just don't know exactly how my mother felt about everything. I just know what happened to her.
Mm-hmm. But does she have journals or letters that you can
draw on? Oh, absolutely.
And
though she went to New York to teach school for a while, and she had any number of flirtations through the mail.
Oh.
And the way they write to each other and how they court one another is quite charming.
Where was she from?
Plattsburgh.
She was also from Plattsburgh.
Yeah.
Okay. And I was going to ask if you've read anything lately that you would recommend to listeners, some book that you thought was really great.
Sarah J. Henry has written two books. The first was Learning to Swim.
Okay.
And the second one was A Cold and Lonely Place. And I heard her once talk about her book at the League of Vermont Writers, useful organization.
Yeah.
If you're interested in writing. And so I picked it up then, and I just like the way she does things. Things move very, very fast. But she has good, strong characters that I find interesting, and the plot is there.
Great.
What I love to read these days are books that have characters in them that I can relate to and that I really care about.
Yeah.
And she has a way of presenting these characters who are almost like part of a family that I want to, be associated with.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, we'll have to look her name up so that we
well
can
written,
say.
I think. But I've been going through several books, and I get halfway through, and so I'm halfway through three books now.
Oh, okay.
I've gone back to a Patricia Cornwall one that I haven't read in a long time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. She's always entertaining. Yeah. All right, so I have
Oh, here's another book I like very much. His name is Seth, and he, Vikram, he wrote An Equal Music.
Okay.
It was quite a while ago. It's about a string quartet that were together for a very long period of time, and how they relate to one another, how they do their music together, and how that is a family.
Oh.
That have disagreements, but they have to resolve them and have agreements to make music.
Cool.
And the metaphor is very clear there. And, I do recommend that to
that
anybody who
great.
Loves music and likes the idea of, how do people relate to one another.
That's great. Thank you. That's a good one.
On that.
Haven't heard that one before. All right, so I just have one last question.
Okay.
I wondered what advice you have for someone who writes either biography or autobiography, which you've written both of. writing some, well, maybe biography, writing someone else's history, or autobiography, writing your own history, like any advice you have for people about those two things?
Absolutely, because I lived a life primarily as a scientist, writing many scientific papers, and it took me a very long time to learn how to write in a different venue. And it's been very helpful to get other people's who are in the trade, get their opinion, their advice. I met early on a very fine editor who has since moved out of the area, Linda Bland. She helped me much with the first book and how to focus and how to, you know, not go off on tangents. And how to write for the lay public for, you know, in science, you just write the facts, ma'am, right?
Yeah.
And you aren't allowed to speculate a great deal unless you're writing a treatise on something, which doesn't happen very often. But in what I call, what we call now creative nonfiction,
yes.
I think that's a very interesting term.
Yeah.
Because all nonfiction is creative.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be selective. Everybody has a selective memory. You use that, but then you try to put it in some context, in some format that moves from one point to the next. And use language that is understandable to most people who might be reading this. It's a skill. It's taken me several years to learn how to write that way.
Do you think that it's harder with nonfiction or autobiography to get rid of stuff that has to go in order to serve the book better, even though maybe it was an interesting part of the story that you're trying to tell? Do you know what I'm talking about? Like killing your babies or killing your darlings, as Chekhov said.
Yeah, well, it's hard. Certainly harder coming from a science background. But I wouldn't say that actually. Coming from a science background, that's what you stick to the facts, and you stick to the point and you focus.
Right.
Here you have to embellish, but then how far do you go
in
embellishing? And that's the trick, I think. You don't want to say too much. Who was the head of the Washington Post? Catherine Graham wrote an autobiography about, you know, her experience with the Washington Post. Ultimately, and she was a very famous Washington Post owner and editor and so forth. But she had to work for it because it went to first her brother and then her husband and until she was able to take it over.
Okay.
And I thought her autobiography was full of very interesting facts, all the people she met, but it needed to be edited to the point where, you know, some of those details could have weren't that important.
Right.
It kind of distracted you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think one does learn from reading. One does learn, you know, how do you want to write?
Absolutely.
What is it that suits you? And what suits you doesn't necessarily suit everybody by any means.
Right. And it's funny, I think that the more you read, the more you sort of learn how you want to write, but the less likely you are to just parrot one person, you know?
Exactly.
Just find a style that's your own.
Right.
That's sort of maybe an amalgam of many other people's influences.
Yeah. I'm envious of people who can write fiction. In fact, I've tried a few things like that, and it's kind of fun, but I can't keep it up.
No.
And I think it's great when if you've got the imagination. I find things in my own life interesting and my own experiences interesting and the people in my life, some of the people in my life quite interesting. So I guess that's what really, maybe that's why I'm a scientist.
Maybe.
Because I'm looking for facts.
Right.
And what's behind what I see.
Mm-hmm.
I belong to a group now called... it's the Burlington Writers Workshop.
Oh, sure.
And I belong to the group called Creative Nonfiction Writing. And it's a wonderful group. There's about a dozen of us. We get together every other week.
And that's part of the Burlington Writers Workshop?
Exactly. And we criticize or we analyze one another's submissions.
Uh-huh.
And they're all different people.
Yeah.
And different experiences and different ways of presenting those experiences. So I get a real exposure as to different approaches through this group. And I learn from it. I think it's a constantly, you need to constantly be learning whatever it is you're doing.
Yeah.
That's one of them.
That's great. Well, I'll just ask you really quickly. I thought that it was amazing that this story takes place in Welcome, North Carolina. Where is Welcome and what happened to it?
Welcome is just west of Winston-Salem.
Okay.
They could take the horse cart with a load of wagon wheel logs to Winston-Salem and sell them there. So it was close enough to do that by horse. It is now virtually a suburb of Winston-Salem. Mm. The old farmhouse that they had was used for practicing firefighters to burn it down and try to put it out. And
which
I have
was
a picture
sort of
that.
Heartbreaking, frankly.
Well, in a way, but, you know, all the family had left and, you know, and it was replaced by a very, you know, 19
modest
something.
Brick
house. Yeah, modest brick house with a paved road instead of a dirt road. And it has a sign outside saying welcome at the edge of the community. Welcome to the Rotary Club and the Boy Scouts of America and the Cub Scouts and the DAR, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Like any little town.
When did they burn the house down?
I don't know exactly, but I did see it before it was burned down, and we found among a bunch of cherry trees that had been cut down, a lot of the kind of mushroom that my husband and I had studied.
Oh, interesting.
For our science that I've written about in my first book.
Yeah. Okay. The name of the book is An American Harvest by Cardi Raper, and it's published by Green Writers Press. Cardi, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
That, again, was a conversation with Cardi Raper. You can learn more about her work at the website cardiraper.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is to find an old letter, journal entry, or recording either from your own life or something that you find at the library or in an archive. Find a historical document that speaks to you in some way and write about its significance. Either write a fictional piece, a poem, or nonfiction, letting your starting point be this documented communication. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. I'm excited to say that I'm sitting in the new radio studio at WBTV LP, which is going to be airing on 99.3 FM in coming months, and should be streaming soon as well. That's where Write the Book is going to be airing every Monday from 3 to 5 once this radio station goes live, and I will keep you posted about when that's going to happen. Today I'm just practicing using their board and recording my show here for the fun of it. So that's exciting and fun, and I'm looking forward to that happening. So I just want to finish up by saying that if you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And as I said earlier, if you like the show, please rate it on iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. Have a great week.